Hi, Jake Werner. Welcome again to KBOO.
Great to be back on.
Jake Werner works at the Quincy Institute on Statecraft. His responsibility is to work with others to be sure to moderate the struggles between the U.S. and China and avoid a hot war between the two. So, Jake, as we discussed in part one of our interview, several top military officials and many pundit experts are predicting that mutual U.S. and China provocations by warships, fighter planes, on and over the South China Sea will evolve into full-scale war within the next 2 years. And U.S.-China conflicts are not just military. China is also challenging U.S. domination of international economic structures and influence in the world. Several weeks ago, we examined the emergence of their great power conflict and possible war between them. We concluded that at its core, the U.S.-China struggle resides in, on the one hand, the U.S., its continuing demand for global economic and military supremacy, and on the other, the Chinese, they're driven by my senses that they resent and are driven by over 200 years of European domination and humiliation for them of reducing China to a vassal state. Chinese leaders and people deeply desire respect and winning its place in the sun, even displacing this country as a world leader. Again, that was part one of our interview. Jake Werner also works with many collaborators in statecraft and peace movements. He works on policies to rebuild constructive economic and military relations with China. So that will be the subject of this week's discussion. So, Jake, give us the fundamentals of the negotiation and policies and the deal or deals that U.S. peace movements and groups like yours are promoting to U.S. policymakers. Maybe start with the military issues centered on Taiwan.
Yeah, this is a good place to start because this is potentially the most explosive issue. Although the emergence of Taiwan as a serious problem in the relationship has come at the end of a long deterioration. So I think it's important first to place the potential conflict over Taiwan as an outcome of the collapse of the U.S.-China relationship, not something that could be solved if the relationship were on a sound footing. So we do need to take measures in the short term to stabilize this issue so that it doesn't run out of control because it's so provocative on both sides. But the long-term solution really resides in getting the U.S.-China relationship back on a healthy footing. But in the short term, we need both sides to each reassure the other that they respect this strange, ambiguous status quo where Taiwan remains self-ruling, even though it is not officially an independent country. Both sides think that the other side is trying to erode that status quo. And so a credible reassurance on each side that they support the status quo and will stick with it indefinitely is very important for stabilizing the really dangerous deterioration in the relationship right now.
One question, I don't know if we're going to have time. It seems to me another area of contestation that could get even more serious than the Taiwan Straits, what's happening there. Weapons in space, the U.S. insists that my sense is the U.S. refuses to sign any international treaty that would make space like most of the oceans that are free for transport and some use, now that's complicated how it is done, of the oceans, at least not so close to the shorelines of any country, miles away. Anyway, basically, weapons in space is another area where the U.S. is really demanding complete supremacy and trying to build it and creating an arms race or sort of a race to be able to control space.
Yeah, this is a real problem. And it sort of symbolizes bigger problems that the U.S. priority when it comes to military issues has been to maintain freedom of movement. So if China expands its navy, that limits the freedom of movement to the United States in the Pacific. If the United States accepts a treaty demilitarizing space, that limits freedom of movement to the United States. And it's this sort of military first slant to U.S. foreign policy that is really debilitating to diplomatic options that could lead to an international system that was much more favorable, actually, to Americans and to U.S. interests. I think it's in everyone's interest to demilitarize space. I totally agree with you. And I think reducing the prominence of the military in all realms of life in all places in the world. That's in everyone's interest. So a big part of the question in the U.S.-China relationship really gets to this deeper feature of U.S. politics and U.S. foreign policy, which is, can we as Americans accept a multipolar system of global power? Can we accept limitations on our right to use our military as we see fit? Can we reduce the militarism in our culture? These are all really important, and it's really going to affect whether we're able to create a world in which we can enjoy peace, or whether we're going to push the world into a global conflict.
Right. This is Bill Resnick for Cable Radio, Old Mo Variety Hour, 9 a.m. Pacific time every Monday. The variety is in the movements from below that we cover. I'm talking to Jake Werner of the Quincy Institute for Statecraft, whose beat is China, whose responsibility is to join with other groups and movements in the United States, to join with them to contain its competition with China on all the military and economic details, and make peace with China, at all means avoid war, and developing policies for getting them to cooperate on the policies through which humanity can deal with really the great threats that we face: climate roasting, nuclear proliferation, lethal pandemics, terrible distribution of the fruits of our human labors. We've so far discussed making peace on the military front. Now, in this interview, we will go on to discuss the economic front of U.S.-China struggle. And here, the Biden administration has been very active, indeed developed an industrial policy that the U.S. has always done, hidden in the military budget items, which is how the U.S. successfully developed the computer, among other successful innovations. And now under Biden, there's also an industrial policy being conducted. It's with the Inflation Reduction Act and other big pots of federal money with misleading titles. All this is necessary to compete with China to develop products for high-tech and electric autos and batteries and clean electricity, solar and wind projects. So the U.S. is spending huge amounts of dollars to incent companies into research and development. We're also wooing India, threatening China, actually, with promises to shift U.S. industry to India. There's economic espionage that the U.S. is worried about, and they've imprisoned one of the leaders of the Huawei company for economic espionage, and they've tried to hobble European companies. They've been lobbying European countries not to buy Huawei products that include these fancy inverters and programmable controllers, other products that could in some way have been built to store information that the Chinese can only get access to. And then there's the attack on TikTok, and the U.S. is fighting the Chinese effort through their loans to other countries. And anyway, talk about that for a bit.
Yeah, I think, as we talked about last time, the U.S. leaders have become increasingly insecure just about the ability of the United States economy to prosper. And a lot of these moves, the industrial policy, the rejection of a lot of free market dogma that has really been very damaging to the United States and to the entire world over the last 30 years, that's motivated by this insecurity. And a big reason that the Biden administration has been able to get support, political support for this, is by pitching this as a way to counter China. So I think that I very much support the end of the hold of free market dogma over our politics. I think, however, that it's being done in the name of conflict with China is really quite disastrous, and it's going to end up deforming the outcome. Right? And one way that you can see this, obviously you can see this in the way that the U.S.-China relationship is being poisoned, because the Biden administration is actively trying to exclude Chinese companies from advanced fields. It is blockading the acquisition of certain advanced technology by all Chinese companies. It's trying to destroy particular Chinese companies like Huawei. So you can see it there, but you can also see it in the fields that are being prioritized. The Biden industrial policy really focuses on certain high-profit, technologically advanced fields like semiconductors, like batteries for use in the climate transition. So it's wonderful that finally the US government is prioritizing the climate transition. This is many, many years past due. But the reason that it's getting prioritized is because the Biden administration says this is the place where we're going to have high profits and good jobs in the future, and the United States needs to dominate those industries. So again, we see there the zero-sum framework. The United States needs to dominate these industries, and in order to do that, we have to exclude other countries, especially China, possibly even our allies. There's some debate over that. But anyway, it's a zero-sum framework. It doesn't say everyone should have access to green energy. Everyone should make the climate transition. Everyone should have good jobs. Everyone should be able to exchange, as long as that exchange is done through good jobs, through high labor standards, through environmentally sustainable methods. That is not what the Biden administration is saying. What they're saying is we need to dominate these fields because that's where the profits are. That's what will give us good jobs, although there's not that many jobs, honestly, in many of these fields. But it really has a lot to do with profits, maintaining the power of American corporations, maintaining the strategic power of the U.S. military. And for that reason, then, a lot of equally vital investments are getting completely neglected. So the livelihood of people involved in health and education, for example, this is an afterthought. There's far more people who are in these fields. These fields are at least as important to the future of this country, but they are being starved of resources. And when we look at this globally, the climate transition is extraordinarily important, maybe the most important thing in the entire world. But it's also very important to the billions of people who currently don't have access to basic sanitation, to sewer systems, to basic transportation, roads, railroads. We don't have access to clean energy. We don't have clean air. All of these things are extraordinarily urgent and are likewise getting neglected because of the way that U.S.-China competition is framing the priorities. So I see focusing on that wider range of human needs as a way of escaping the zero-sum constraints that we're under right now. Because investing in those, in that much wider set of issues, would increase growth, it would increase productivity, it would create opportunities for businesses, it would improve the power and the conditions of workers. And all of those together would lead to higher growth, more sustainable growth, and a way for US and Chinese businesses to succeed at the same time. They don't have to think in these zero-sum terms. But unfortunately, because they're thinking in these zero-sum terms, they're not able to collaborate on these kinds of projects that would allow us to escape the zero-sum constraints that are pushing us towards an incredibly destructive conflict.
One final thing. We've come to the end. I've been talking to Jake Werner of the Quincy Institute for Statecraft on the wars with China, Cold War threatening to become a hot war. We talked about how to build peace, what the U.S. could do, what must do. Although, you know, your program in the context of the U.S. power forces, it's a very, very small minority of Americans who right now are supportive of that program. And they have basically, well, maybe a few of the congresspersons, which a number of them actually would share your commitment to your program and actually believe it could be done soon, or at least soon enough to escape the inevitable global roasting that we seem to be moving towards. So what would you say, Jake Werner, to people who say, boy, that's utopian?
The landscape does not look promising. I agree with that. But I think it is important to note that the U.S., the people of the United States, do not support the direction that we're going in. People have very negative associations with China. Some of these are for good reasons, because the Chinese government is, as we talked about last time, is very repressive. Some of them are not so good reasons. The threat that China poses to the United States is very small. But regardless of how they feel about China overall, they are not highly invested in a confrontation with China, particularly one that would lead to serious conflict. The problem is that that is not the case for the elite in Washington. The elite in Washington is highly invested in confrontation with China, and they're moving us towards a very destructive conflict. So the way to change this is to get the desire of the American people for peace, for better livelihoods, for a healthier and friendlier international system, reform the global economy in ways that work for not just American workers, but workers all over the world. Those are things that are widely supported, but they're not being expressed politically in Washington right now. So the way to change this is to get these priorities expressed in a politically powerful way in Washington, which means talking to your representatives, which means joining with other people who are active on this to make sure that the U.S. government is responsive to the priorities of the American people. We are not in a situation where a constructive and positive relationship between the U.S. and China is politically impossible at the popular level. And so we need to translate that, those desires of the American people, into something that can work politically. That's a part of it. I mean, all of these different realms are kind of interconnected, but I think it's worth trying to analyze them separately. Like one of the reasons that the security realm feels zero sum, a really central reason, is that the United States has enjoyed military and political hegemony over most of the world for ever since the end of the Cold War. So for three decades now. And countries, including China and Russia, but also including other countries, India, Brazil, South Africa, countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, all of these places have become more or less dissatisfied with the exercise of American hegemony, and they have grown in power, relative power, compared to the United States. So we really need to be thinking about how to move from a situation of global military and political unipolar hegemony to one that is multipolar and that gives a place to all these other countries, which after all represent the majority of people in the world, gives a place for them to shape the way that the global system is run. So that requires us to think about, first of all, it requires American leaders to stop feeling like they have to have absolute domination or else they have no ability to succeed. So we need to give up this commitment to American hegemony that most American leaders continue to hold. And rather than sort of futilely trying to hang on to that and creating all kinds of conflict as we try to defend the persistence of American hegemony, we should be thinking about how to shape institutions, which the United States will have an important role in and will be able to exercise leadership in, but nonetheless will also give a place for other countries to have leadership and exercise influence. We need to be thinking about how to reform international institutions like the UN, like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the whole machinery of global governance. We should be thinking about how to democratize it in a managed way, not in a way that sort of runs out of control where different countries are trying to seize power each from the other. And that really requires the US and China in particular, but a lot of other significant countries to come into to convene a set of inclusive negotiations. One of the problems right now is that U.S. initiatives, U.S. global initiatives all seem intended to exclude China. And that's inevitably going to lead to conflict. We need to have a discussion of how to reform the way that the global system works, also the way that the global economy works. But fundamentally, all of these discussions have to be inclusive. They can't be understood as being intended to exclude any of the countries that need to have a voice in them. I think that the climate issue has, you know, like for most people, it's not a priority, but for people who have really understood how important it is, it has allowed them to see the global stakes globally and the need for some kind of global solution rather than just trying to fix things in one country. And there has been a huge amount of progress just on raising the political importance of climate in the US and also in China and all over the world just in the last like 5 years or so. So that, I think, you know, I am often very pessimistic, but I think that is really worth appreciating that we have seen a lot of progress in some ways, and yes, we can try to build on that.
Yeah, I hope so. Anyway, you were great. Thank you. Thank you a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Great talking to you.